From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It's hard to think of another place so rich with major gardens as the Brandywine Valley in Chester County, Pennsylvania, and an adjacent portion of Delaware. And five of those gardens have a historic connection, a family connection, as they were all by members of the DuPont family. A new book portrays the story of those places, and its photographer and writer are here today to take us on some virtual visits to these must-see gardens. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
The new book, DuPont Gardens of the Brandywine Valley, profiles five gardens created by generations of the DuPont industrial family. Longwood, Winterthur, and Mount Cuba are among them, in photographs by Larry Letterman and words by Marta McDowell, both of whom I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. And Marta, it's good to talk to you again. I haven't talked to you in a while, but I hope all is well in both of your worlds. And you've certainly been doing, it looks like you two did some garden visiting and certainly studying up on some of these gardens because, wow, it's a big book full of photographs and text as well. And as I said in the introduction, the five gardens, it's not like they're related entities managed by the same organization or anything, are they? They're related by human ancestry. Is that right, Larry?
Yes. And they have their unique histories and different branches of the family. I spent about a year and a half photographing them, and I went down every 2 weeks and stayed for two or three days. When I went down, I had a place at Longwood where I could stay. It was actually my COVID project.
Oh.
Yeah, so I started in 2021 in the spring. I usually like to start in the winter, but it ran. I took two springs to do this because spring is such an important part of the gardens and the process. So that's basically the arc of it, of the experience.
Right. Now, Marta, you like Larry, you've both been to many gardens. But do you think, and I'll ask both of you, but I'll ask Marta first, do you guys think there's any other sort of that small an area geographically that really rivals the Brandywine Valley in terms of its, I mean, it has the nickname America's Garden Capital, right? It's really amazing, the riches of horticulture that are, I think there's like 30 gardens within 30 miles of Philadelphia that are, you know, visitor-friendly types of places.
It is one of those beacons, Margaret. I mean, there are beautiful gardens all around the world, but this is really a concentration. So I have a friend who just came up from North Carolina, and she went just to that area, and I think in 2 days saw 10 gardens and sort of had total overload. But, you know, it's doable there.
Yeah. Yeah. Larry, is there any other place you can think of that has such a, I mean, I can't come up with something, but.
No, you know, it's interesting. When I was called to do this, the person who called me had been on the board of Winterthur, and he suggested one or two gardens. And I said, all five of the public gardens, because they're so close. But I realized that, you know, it's in the book, Marta says that there are, these together are about 5 square miles. So if you think about it, it's huge in its own way. And yet each is discrete and you can see them, and each is diverse. So
right.
That in a sense, you don't get, your palate doesn't get jaded by going to one garden and then another. I mean, each is a different experience.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about that. I think, as you were just referring to, I mean, I think it says in the book that the five DuPont family gardens that are in this book cover more than 3,500 acres in total landscape. So, I mean, between naturalistic areas and like woodlands and so forth and formal gardens. But So today we know these places as public gardens, but they were private homes in this sort of different era of time. So let's talk just a little bit sort of scene setting, because I think you write in the book, Marta, that you know, this, it wasn't the first DuPont who came from France. I guess was he E.I. DuPont? Did he come in 1800? It wasn't the first DuPont who made all these gardens. It was great grandchildren and great grand—I forget—but like descendants. So it was a long lineage of garden makers. Is that right?
Absolutely. They were all tree planters, I should say, and they all gardened to some extent. But the really great generation of garden makers were those people in the really country place era. So those, you know, first decades of the 20th century, you know, the great DuPont fortunes had already been made, you know, and they continued to work. So, you know, many of these garden makers worked in various aspects of the DuPont Corporation, but they were exercising, I don't know, they were flexing, you know, so they had this money, and this was one way that they expressed themselves, not the only way, but one important way.
Right, right. So history. So from the start, and I can't pronounce his proper name, but E.I. DuPont, when he came in January 1800, I think, to the United States, there's a quote in the book that says, he wrote a letter to someone and said, I guess back home or whatever, said, "When I began building my establishment here, it was like settling in a back country. No road, no decent house, no garden." And then he added, "Being without a garden was the greatest deprivation, and it's the first thing that occupied my time." So he was a determined garden maker for sure. Now, his garden, Larry, that is Hagley, yes?
That's Hagley, yes. And what's interesting is that in the book, we show a picture of the stone barn they built, which is huge. It's monumental. It's a bank barn so that you can drive up or get a cart up into the second floor and so forth. It was, in fact, when they started, basically their home, which they shared with the animals. And then they branched out and built the house. And then later, years later, they built the office. And then the garden was very early because they needed the food and the crops. So that, in a sense, it's a true American story in a way. It's agrarian in that way. And yet they then used the river to create this great industrial empire, because it is the power, that the water power, which they use as the energy to create, to move the mills, to move the turbines and so forth.
Right. So for Larry, as a photographer, you know, looking at Hagley, I haven't been there, but I've read a lot about it, and I've talked to the person who's charged with kind of bringing it back. It's kind of a, its bones are there, but a lot of it's in ruin almost. I mean, it's not like a fancy, you know, it doesn't look like Longwood. Let's put it that way.
Well, it's actually the most enticing in its own way.
Uh-huh.
It has its industrial history. And I had not been expecting, when I got there, to see the ruin that they had, which the Crown and Shields had built. They had built a fantasy world where they had this Italianate garden. And you walk down from the house and you walked into a classical environment with a huge gate, which they had taken parts of from Italy and so forth. And they had statuary, and it has a classic quality to it, and it has an industrial quality to it, because they used the great iron or steel cauldrons that were used in the mill to create as ornaments and so forth.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was surprised by the ruin when I got there, and it was raining that day. but it had been raining, and it had this kind of quality to it. The air and the light had this quality to it, a fog and so forth, and mystery. And they said, oh God, the weather's not very good. And I said, no, this is magnificent. I said, it's a fairy tale, and this is a way to tell it.
Yeah. So Marta, I mean, it is, it's to write about it, it's different from, you know, a lot of gardens, because the, right, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not all gussied up. It's, there are plants that still come back through all the overgrowth and whatever, you know, things that were planted there a long, long time ago. How, this is an old garden, you know, again, like the remnant of an old garden, right?
So the wonderful thing about Hagley is it's really two gardens, and they're on two sides of the old sort of homestead, if you will, the original DuPont house. So up the hill from the house, there's this French potager, and it's in beautiful condition because it was restored, I think, in the 1970s, and it's still beautifully tended, just what you'd expect, you know, the espaliered fruit trees and all beautiful pruning and all very precise. And then if you go down the hill to the back of the house, you find this other garden that Larry's describing, and it was created over 100 years after the first one. So again, this is the one created by that first DuPont, E.I. DuPont's granddaughter and her, or excuse me, great-granddaughter. I've got my generations confused too.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Her husband, the Crown and Shields. And it's really magical. I mean, as Larry said, you know, it's either fairy tale, or to me, it was kind of haunting. You know, it's vaguely in ruin. It's just, it's a feeling in a garden that I have not had often. I mean, there was like the Lost Garden at Heligan, which I saw once in Cornwall. You know, it's really nothing I've seen in the U.S. So it's got so much potential. And as you say, part of this magic is in the spring, the bulbs that Louise Crown and Shield planted still come up and bloom.
You
know, some of the trees are there. So that's very cool.
Yeah, it's very, very crazy. Yeah. So you hinted at it before, Marty, you said something about like they were all tree planters. You know, I was thinking as I looked through the book and read through the book, you know, that it's not just horticulture, and this was horticulture on a grand scale at these estates, but there's also arboriculture, you know, there's the love and the care of trees and so forth. So Larry is, I mean, someone looking at these places, figuring out how to showcase them in photography, I mean, trees are such an important signature of these gardens, and they're also such big characters in any photograph, yeah? So, I mean, you must have had quite a time. There's a lot of pictures that involve important trees and alleys of trees and so forth, yes?
Well, yes. Well, I started photography because I got an interest in trees, and I just love them, and I once started, I thought I would make an inventory of the trees I had on my property, but I'm not an inventory kind of person. And somebody said to me, why don't you get a camera and take pictures of them? So I went out and bought a camera, and that's how I actually started developed my interest in photography. So, and then I did a book on the trees of the New York Botanical Garden, because that was my real interest before I started doing gardens, you know, the whole garden. And so when I got down to Wilmington and looked at the trees, I couldn't believe it. I mean, the basis for Longwood was Pierce Woods, which was a couple hundred years old before Pierre bought it. And he bought it because he wanted to save the trees. And they had planted all kinds of specimen trees. So I had a field day there. But, and then Winterthur has these wonderful trees, poplars that are huge, and so does Mount Cuba. I mean, they, in a way, I hadn't seen trees like this before. The New York Botanical Garden has an alley of poplars they are, because they're all in a group, they wound up very, very branchy. But these trees really grow to the sky. In the 19th century, they were used to make masts for sailing ships. So it gives you a sense of what was there and what was there for the purposes of photography. And then in Winterthur, the one thing that Henry did was he created what is called the March Bank. He underplanted all these trees so that when March and the spring starts, the woodland just starts to become a fairyland.
Yes, it does. It certainly does. It's famous for that. And anyone who's a garden lover should make a trip to this area, if only for that in the spring. But I mean, there's so much spring going on. But so you mentioned Pierre and you mentioned Henry. So let's just quickly, Marta, maybe you can help us. Let's just go through the five gardens. We're talking Pierre DuPont and Henry DuPont and so forth. So we started with E.I. DuPont, who came from France in 1800. And he made the garden, he built the place at Hagley and so forth. And that was the beginning. So the other four, who's who in this mix?
Okay. So we'll go to Pierre. Pierre Samuel DuPont created Longwood. Yeah. His cousins included Henry Francis DuPont, who created Winterthur, and Louise DuPont Crowninshield, who created that other garden at Hagley.
Okay.
As well as Alfred DuPont, who creates Nemours. And okay. Then one generation down, you have Lamont DuPont Copeland, who with his wife Pamela Copeland creates Mount Cuba. So yes, that's the gang.
So like formality to informality, I'm going to guess that, and again, none of them is informal. These are all, you know, grand places relative to how most of us live. But I'm going to guess that I would put Mount Cuba as the least formal landscape in a way of all of these. And I don't know which one I would say is the most formal. How would you guys rate them, kind of? Well,
in terms of formality, Nemours is at the top.
Okay.
Because it's a French garden.
Okay.
French garden. I would say, as a woodland garden, which is interesting, I would say Winterthur is probably the most interesting of the gardens as a woodland garden. And Mount Cuba, which I would say ranks next to it in that regard, because it has woodlands and natural lands.
There's
about 1,000 acres. And that's how I would rate it on that basis. And Hagley's the least, it's basically, it's a family garden, really, and a museum in part. Did I cover everybody? I think I covered everybody. Yes. Longwood. Yes. Longwood is a display garden. Pierre was a showman.
Yeah.
And so Longwood is a display garden. It has wonderful woods. It has everything. But the centerpiece is the fact that it has idea gardens and walks of flowers. In the book, you'll see, as far as the eye can see, there are photographs showing flowers.
Yeah. So I want to spend, a few minutes. We have maybe 5-6 minutes. And I want to spend some of our time, or a lot of our time that's remaining, kind of talking about, you know, what you guys kind of take away from doing a project where you focus on gardens of this scale and laden with this much history and so forth. Because obviously, again, most of us don't have a landscape of this scale or of this history, or any of the degree of formality in these. So what are some of the things that, you know, and Marta, we can start with you, we can go back and forth, things that, you know, really you think, wow, okay, my place is really different, but that's a lesson for me. What are some of the takeaways that stand out in your mind?
So I'm going to start with the hardest one, I think, and that was Nemours, which is, you know, it's a French garden, so that isn't my style of gardening, you know, in this kind of, I don't know, Versailles-esque style. Mm-hmm. And yet when I think about it, what Nemours offers, and a, like a careful walk through Nemours, not just looking at the view and then going, you know, going inside and saying, okay, we're done, but walking through, you find a sort of things that reveal themselves one at a time. So you walk down this grand vista, and all of a sudden you come to this maize garden, which wasn't visible
right
from above. Or you go down this, you know, this grand alley of trees, the approach to the house, and you look to the side and you realize that they've like opened up windows, you know, if we want to use a fancy word, it's like fenestrated, right? Where you get this peak and you go, yeah, I could do that in my garden by, you know, positioning shrubs and trees in a certain way, or maybe putting up a trellis so that you have to go around it. So that's one takeaway from Nemours.
Okay. So that's kind of a hide and reveal. Don't let me see the whole picture all at once. That reminder for a gardener in any scale. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Larry, do you have one that sticks out for
you? Well, let me, I start this way, not being trained at all. And so I ask the questions, do you walk or do you sit?
Oh.
Is there a journey?
Okay.
The use of water. In other words, is there a bridge to cross? Do shrubs make rooms? And is there a place where you have a retreat when you that's totally closed to you and you can contemplate? So that's the way I look at it.
Uh-huh.
And, then the garden sort of fit into that kind of experience. So you take Nemours, it's basically a grand surprise. You start at the top and you have the sense, as Martha said, of having seen everything. But as you walk down what's called the long walk, everything gets revealed.
Right.
In Longwood, you go from display to display to display to display. So it's not really a, but there are lots of places to sit.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get there, you can walk, and you can sit. And in Mount Cuba, it's sort of, what's interesting about Mount Cuba, I think of it as a series of concentric circles. Around the house, there's a formal garden where you can sit. And then as you move past the center and move out into the periphery, and as you radiate out, you get to a meadow, and then you get to a pond, and so forth. So there's a kind of a surprise there as it changes, and the sense is as the family spread its wings, all these things began to develop.
Yes.
And with a winter tour, what you have is you have something which is decorated, but it's playful. For example, the sundial garden used to be the tennis court. And Henry couldn't resist pulling it up and planting it, you know? And there are all these gazebos around so that you always have a sense of where things are in relation to everything else. So he organizes, in a sense, that garden, which is huge, by monuments in different places, as you can see.
So, so in the last couple of minutes, you know, I think for me, looking through the book and all your great photographs, Larry, and reading, you know, the stories you've told of each garden, Marta. I mean, the other thing I feel like is that the power of formality against a naturalistic, and as we've talked about, each of these places also has some woods or something. There's some parts that are less structured, less formal. The power of formality, and it's something that as we get wilder in our gardens and focused more on natives and so forth, I think it makes a great juxtaposition, even in a loose, you know, even in a meadow, to have some formal element. Do you know what I mean? Do you guys know what I mean?
Absolutely. So, you know, you take Mount Cuba. Mount Cuba does such a stellar job of studying and displaying plants of the Piedmont region. And yet it also has composition and focal points, right? It has something right. That draws your eye into it. It's got, you know, paths that move you through it. It's, as you know, as Larry says, you've got places to sit. It's definitely got the compositional elements that we would call more formal. So that's the thing to remember. Sometimes I see people doing valiant efforts at native plant gardens or native plant yards, and they haven't quite remembered that part.
Right, the structure, right. Well, I could talk to you about these beautiful gardens a lot longer, but we've run out of time, and I want to congratulate you both. Larry, congratulations for making this happen, and Marta for bringing it to life with the words, because the stories of these gardens are very interesting as well. So thank you both for making time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you very much, Margaret.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Marta.
And yes. Thank you, Larry.
Good. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and garden visiting meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.